It is Wednesday, March 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Britain announces it will expel 23 Russian diplomats following the poisoning of a former Russian spy. World-famous physicist Stephen Hawking dies at the age of 76.
He was a man of passion, loved life, and wasn't going to be held back by a debilitating disease.
And a new group brings positive change to the food scene. It's all ahead. Britain will take action after Moscow shrugged off demands to explain how a deadly Soviet-era nerve agent came to be used in an English town to poison former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia. Prime Minister Theresa May spoke to the House of Commons Wednesday. Reporter Jamie Detmer tells me about the British reprisals against Moscow.
The immediate measure was the expulsion of 23 diplomats, Russian diplomats from London, who the British government say are in fact undeclared Russian intelligence officers. This would be the biggest expulsion of diplomats from the UK since the height of the Cold War, actually 1971, when over 90 were expelled by the then Labour government. That's the most immediate one. But there are a raft of other measures that she's talking about, which mainly focused on financial, whereby legislation that's already to hand, they're going to start investigating Russian assets. A lot of oligarchs close to the Kremlin, as well as the inner circle of Mr. Putin, own property in London, in Britain, very expensive property. And there are lots of their dollars and rubles in assets held by the banks as well. So if someone cannot really explain where their wealth comes from, or there is a suspicion of corruption, the British government can start seizing assets, and they will start doing so, I suspect, as this unfolds. They're talking about new anti-espionage measures. They're talking about increased monitoring, tracking of Russians flying in from overseas, which means some visa bans will come. And very significantly, they have decided to suspend all high-level contacts between British officials and Russian officials, including stopping a planned visit by the foreign minister from Russia, Sergei Lavrov. They've left the ambassador in place at the moment and not expelled him, partly because they need to have some kind of communication conduit as this all plays out.
I believe that Britain wanted the Russians to respond to their questions concerning this poisoning. I don't believe there's been any official response yet.
Well, the official response was, we're not responding. They were given until midnight Wednesday, Tuesday night Wednesday, to explain why this mercury-grade nerve agent, the British says, was used in the attack, Novichok, which was developed in the Soviet era in labs in the 1970s, 1980s at laboratories in Russia, why that was present in the UK. And they were given this choice, either say that you approved this killing or that you lost control of this. Now, the response from the Russians has been, we're not going to respond. You should go through different channels. There are a variety of international channels you can go through. We also want a sample of this nerve agent before we respond. They have responded, however, officially to the reprisals, saying the foreign ministry a couple of hours ago said that there would be a response. So I think that what we will see is a tit-for-tat expulsion of British diplomats from Moscow. And this really means that we're going to see an escalation for a while in this confrontation.
I watched some of Prime Minister May's comments on television, and I noticed the response in Parliament seemed very supportive, no matter which party the members were from.
Yes, the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, who is probably the most far-left leader Labour's had in since about the 1920s, was not that supportive. He said he was being supportive, but he wanted different methods. He wanted more multilateralism in the British government's response. He got booed. And there was a lining up of Labour MPs, from senior to junior Labour MPs, who were very supportive of the British government and who distanced themselves from their own party leader. Right across the board, from the Scottish Nationalists to the Liberal Democrats, yes, she clearly does have the support of the House of Commons and came under a lot of political pressure in the last few days to take strong action. The political dynamic in the UK is getting more and more angry towards the Russians, because of suggestions from a Soviet-era chemical warfare expert who helped develop this nerve agent, who now lives in America, saying that, in fact, hundreds of people may have been exposed during this attack to trace contamination, and they will have health risks for the rest of their lives. So as well as people being angry that the government hasn't responded possibly enough to a healthcare crisis, a public healthcare crisis, there is a lot of anger building up in the UK towards Russia.
Jamie Detmer reporting. Well, joining me on the line is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending?
You know, Sarah, it's days like today that bring to mind a line that a character says in one of my favorite movies. She's completely flummoxed. She sort of shrugs her shoulders, looks up at the sky, and says, "Everything is happening." And it sort of feels that way today. Here's something that is also happening today that really snuck up on me, and perhaps that's because I'm not a high school student. Thousands upon thousands of high school students across the United States today have been basically staging walkouts, and whether this is for an hour or for a day or a march maybe to a state capitol or something like that. There are literally hundreds of locations, high schools across the country, where thousands upon thousands of students have walked out in basically in protest of what they see as inaction on guns following the shootings in Parkland a month ago. Now, the students are, as they are wont to do, this is their technology. They're using Instagram, they're using Snapchat. Very often you'll see two big hashtags today across social media. One is hashtag never again, and the other is hashtag national school walkout. They're sharing pictures, they're sharing, pictures of signs, pictures of students walking. I actually went down on Pennsylvania Avenue and spent some time. There were thousands of students from high schools in Washington, D.C., in Maryland, in Virginia, you know, close by. And they marched down. They gathered at the White House, sort of a, what they called like a silent protest. They marched down to the Capitol, and they're going to go meet with lawmakers. Now, of course, these young people can't vote. They will be able to soon, but most of them obviously can't vote. But I was really just taken aback at the clarity of what they see as their mission. They were almost to a one. They were amiable. There was, you know, kind of a real sense of this wasn't an angry in any way protest. I don't think there's been a violence at any of these things. But they're sharing their stories using social media, using these hashtags, and they're sharing what is essentially this commitment that, you know what, when we say never again, we mean never again. The adults, they can't seem to get anything done, so we're going to have to do it. And as I say, 201, they were, it was, I hate to use the word, but it's almost like they felt empowered. It was really remarkable to see young people so determined and so clear in their purpose. So yeah, that's a really big thing that's happening today. And, you know, they really self-organize all this stuff using the tool of social media.
All right. Thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The former South Korean president has been questioned in a corruption probe. A New Zealand envoy is censured for a vulgar anti-Trump tweet. Philippines' President Duterte withdraws his nation from the international criminal courts, and as we just heard, U.S. students are staging walkouts to protest gun violence. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Are you stressed out? If so, a new Canadian study hints that you may want to stay away from others who are stressed too. A 2014 study by neuroscientists at the University of California, Berkeley, provided evidence on how chronic stress and elevated cortisol levels can change or possibly damage the brain. The new study, published in the journal Nature Neuroscience, shows that stress conveyed by others can also change your brain in the same way. Jaideep Bains and his team at the University of Calgary made their findings after studying the effects of stress on pairs of male and female mice. Bains suggests that the findings of the mice study may have relevance for humans. We may also unwittingly transmit our own stress to others along with its deleterious brain effects. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at a new way to do catering. World-renowned British physicist Stephen Hawking has died at the age of 76. His family said he died at home in Cambridge, where he worked for decades at the University of Cambridge. Hawking battled amyotrophic lateral sclerosis for decades, losing his ability to speak, leaving him to communicate through a voice synthesizer. He was also confined to a wheelchair. Wendy Friedman is professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of Chicago. She tells me about Hawking's major scientific achievement.
Perhaps the contribution that Stephen Hawking is best known for is his understanding of black holes and the fact that black holes aren't completely black. And before his work, people assumed that nothing could escape from a black hole. And what Stephen Hawking was able to show was that if you allowed for quantum mechanics and the formation of virtual particles, that is, particles and their antiparticles, then sometimes a particle-antiparticle pair would form and one would escape. And so, in fact, the effect is that black holes evaporate, particularly small black holes. And that was a revolutionary discovery.
He was interesting for a scientist in that he was known. He was not only just prominent in the world of science, but he was well known outside of it as well.
I think that's right. I think that's one of the unusual characteristics about Stephen Hawking and why he was so inspiring to so many people, not just scientists, but people around the world who might have had an interest in science, might not have, people who are disabled. He was a man of passion, loved life, and wasn't going to be held back by a debilitating disease. He was an extraordinary man, and I think touched a lot of lives.
He lived for many years with ALS, and I believe he lived much longer, well, than most people who become afflicted with this disease, and certainly much longer than doctors first gave him.
Yeah, he lived about 50 years longer than the doctors first gave him, and most people with ALS do not have lifespans that long. And in his own words, he was very depressed when he first learned of the diagnosis, but then he realized he was still alive, and he wasn't going to be held back by what I think most people would view as daunting challenges. He really was extraordinary.
He was also very interested in space and promoted the space travel of humans.
He was very interested in space and the idea of whether or not there could be space travel in our lifetime, how we would do that, whether there were interesting ways within physics to what people would view as science fiction. He explored those ideas. And yes, he was a strong proponent of human activity in space.
Did you know him? Did you meet him?
I did. I had the good fortune many years ago. He and I gave back-to-back public talks in Japan, and that was a very interesting experience. He certainly, around the world, had fans and gave a public talk that would inspire, I think, pretty much anybody. And I had the opportunity to be at a second wedding with his second wife, where in Japan they celebrated his, at that time, recent second marriage. And so I had the opportunity to celebrate with them. It was a really enjoyable evening for me.
Wendy Friedman, professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of Chicago. President Trump, in announcing he was firing Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, singled out the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement as one example of why he decided to make a change at the State Department. Trump announced his nominee to replace Tillerson is currently director of the Central Intelligence Agency and former Congressman Mike Pompeo. He now must be confirmed by the Senate. During those confirmation hearings, it is likely the fate of U.S. involvement in the international agreement with Iran will be clarified. Benenben Talablu is an Iran analyst at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, ironically, a tough new U.S. policy could actually bring consensus among the Western allies.
Mike Pompeo is someone who's articulated leaving the deal. He's someone who's articulated a strategy that goes after the regime in Tehran. And by publicly touting those options, I think you can get the Europeans to try to better accommodate the American position and come to a much quicker transatlantic consensus on those issues. And ultimately, then, a unified West would take those issues to Iran and try to fix or, quote-unquote, renegotiate the deal.
Well, the president, as you know, Benham, delivered an ultimatum to the European powers in January, saying they must agree to, quote, fix the terrible flaws of the Iran nuclear deal, or he would refuse to extend U.S. sanctions relief on Iran.
The president has publicly sunk costs by saying that this is the last waiver for the U.S. to remain in the deal if the accord is not fixed appropriately abroad. And abroad, the Europeans are, first and foremost, our allies who need to come to a consensus with us on what needs to be fixed, how to fix it, and when to fix it by. You know, it's telling that the deadline is May 12, because that's the piece of legislation that the president has to waive to keep the U.S. in the deal. And that piece of legislation contains the heaviest of the heavy sanctions. Those are the Central Bank of Iran sanctions. So if the Europeans don't meet that deadline, and if there is no transatlantic consensus, and there is no essential promissory notes on those three areas, as Reuters had reported, then we will be in an area where the U.S. will be called on its bluff, if that is a bluff. And if it's not a bluff, then the U.S. will essentially be withdrawing from the deal and threatening, again, sanctions.
As you know, there are other voices in the administration who are counseling to try to preserve the deal, including Defense Secretary Jim Mattis.
I think ultimately, if you want to preserve the deal or fix the deal or even nix the deal, your goal is to essentially have someone who provides a credible option both for a walkout and for remaining in the deal. And Mike Pompeo seems to be that person. Again, he was a congressman before he was CIA director. He's been tough on Iran. He's been tough on another rogue regime that poses a non-proliferation threat. That's North Korea. By having that public toughness, you can improve your private negotiating hand. So, again, whether you want to fix the deal or nix the deal, you need a strong U.S. position. And Mike Pompeo could be someone, as the country's top diplomat, if he's confirmed by the Senate, to represent that strong position.
Benenben Talablu of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. This is International Edition. Chris Spear has been professionally cooking since he was 16. Over the years, he worked for big restaurants and reached a point where he had almost 100 employees reporting to him. That's when he missed flexibility and wanted to be more creative. So he quit working for restaurants and founded his own catering company, Perfect Little Bites. Last January, he found a networking group for independent chefs. As Faiza Almazri tells us, it's chefs without restaurants, and it helps independent chefs share resources and find greater success. Faith Lapidus narrates.
Cooking is Chris Spear's passion, so he doesn't get tired when he spends long hours working in the kitchen. But before he decided to start his own catering service, he was concerned that becoming an independent chef would make him feel lonely. That inspired him to found Chefs Without Restaurants, an online resource for chefs.
I've been thinking about the Chefs Without Restaurants for about 5 years now, even before I took Perfect Little Bites full time, because I kept thinking about, well, when I do this full time, who are going to be my colleagues? Who are going to be people who I can bounce ideas off of? How are we going to be able, you know, how am I going to be able to do things like cater an event that's maybe outside of my range of 30 people? Like, do I have a resource where I can pull in one or two other people? You know, I don't need full-time employees, but kind of building a network.
About 100 chefs have joined the group since Spear launched it last January.
We're caterers, we're personal chefs, we run food trucks, we have awesome food specialty shops, and I kind of wanted to raise awareness for some of those people as well. And I wanted to have something that was beneficial that also didn't cost money. So we're in a Facebook group where I can just post and say, next Wednesday, a customer wants to do a dinner, here's their price range, here's where they live. If anyone's maybe interested, send me a personal message and I'll get you their info.
Customers can also benefit from the network.
We're building a website where you can come on and see profiles of all the members and kind of having what their specialties are. You can see whether they're a caterer doing big parties, a personal chef doing small, someone who has a cooking school. And they can kind of do some of that research themselves and filter and have, you know, links to all of their websites, social media.
Lana and Bobby Browner own the catering company Benton Bent Events and are members of Chefs Without Restaurants.
I think the biggest hurdle for a lot of chefs is that they don't really form an alliance because they're all kind of competing with each other, but you don't have that in this group. I think the benefit of what we've experienced so far is a lot of learning about different chefs in the area, and it's even been interesting to get feedback from chefs that are not in this immediate area.
It's a real competitive feel, but the alliance that's being formed is a lot of camaraderie, a lot of openness, and a lot of sharing. And I think that's the biggest thing that we're going to have to push us forward.
The group is also bringing more business to local facilities, like the shared kitchen Maryland Bakes, where members often meet and work. Its owner, Terry Rowe, says the group brings more energy to the small food businesses in the area.
Well, they bring connections. They bring a variety of talents and gifts. They bring creative ideas and just the whole network of independent people joining together. So it's a big community.
The whole local food community seems to embrace Chefs Without Restaurants. Olive Oil and Vinegar is one of the local businesses where Spear likes to shop. It often hosts events to introduce its customers to new cooking ideas and local chefs. Store owner Sharon Streb says small businesses should help one another succeed.
I think by sharing that and having them come into the store, they get in front of our customers, and hopefully we get in front of their customers, that it's a win-win for both of us. Because it's tough out there being a small business, and a lot of small businesses succeed. So it's important that we can work together and be successful, both of us.
That's a goal shared by Chris Spear, who wants to carve a space for independent chefs on the local food map. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News. And that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is slated to become the world's largest oil producer by the year 2023, according to the International Energy Association, or IEA. The rising demand for oil, said IEA Executive Director Fatih Birol, has unleashed a wave of growth from the United States. American crude production is expected to reach a record of 12.1 million barrels a day in 2023, up from the current 10.6 million a day. This means that the U.S. will outproduce Russia, which currently pumps the most oil at 11 million barrels a day. The American oil boom is being helped by technological advances, improved efficiency, and a moderate increase in oil prices that has made shale drilling cost-effective. Moreover, President Donald Trump has reversed a historic number of regulations to allow use of public and private lands to safely develop oil and gas and other energy resources, including wind and solar. This means that the United States is getting closer to President Trump's stated goal of energy independence. U.S. Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke stressed that opening up of new lands to energy exploration also includes stewardship of the environment. Indeed, he noted that the U.S. is embarking on its largest investment in its public lands and the park system in the history of this country, and it's going to be funded from energy. In a recent discussion forum, U.S. Secretary of Energy Rick Perry noted the importance of allowing the private sector to develop the oil and natural gas sectors. Rapid growth in the production of liquefied natural gas has enabled the U.S. to become a net exporter. As a net exporter, the U.S. is not just exporting energy, but freedom, said Secretary Perry. You think about what that means around the world, that people who want to be our allies now know that because of American energy coming to their shores, they are free from countries that would put those values that those countries have in jeopardy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.